Journalists right now who are reporting on the war and they're talking about the theft of grain from Ukraine can't help but recall that in 1932-33, grain was at the center of an attack on Ukraine.
This is Marta Bazyuk talking about how the ongoing Russian-Ukrainian war brings back memories of the Holodomor, the man-made famine in the years 1932-1933. In what was then the Soviet Republic of Ukraine. Martha is executive director of the Holodomor Research and Education Consortium, based in Canada, and she stresses the importance of the memory of the past famine for the interpretation of what's going on in Ukraine today.
I don't think it's possible to talk about the war without immediately thinking about the context, that something like this doesn't happen out of nowhere, that there is a history to this. And I think that both in Ukraine and in the diaspora, if there's been sometimes a frustration, a minimizing of the importance of the history of Ukraine, and the questioning of whether there was an exaggeration of the Ukrainian element to history, to the fact that the Holodomor was aimed at Ukrainians. I think now with what's going on, there is more receptiveness to considering the imperialism and colonialism as an aspect of Russian actions today and Soviet actions in 32-33.
Marta's words demonstrate that recollections of the past are shaped by present developments and needs. As she emphasizes, past famine suffering gives meaning to the war today, while the war simultaneously changes our perception of the famine. This episode of Neat Rewind is dedicated to the functioning of famine pasts in the present. My name is Anne van Maurik, and this episode is somewhat special to me as it engages with the research project I'm part of as a PhD candidate. The project is named Heritages of Hunger. But before explaining this research, I would first like to introduce my colleague, Lindsay Jansen. She and I conducted the interviews together, so you will also hear her voice in this episode.
Hi, I'm Lindsay, and I'm a researcher and teacher at the Department of Modern Languages and Cultures at Radboud University. I'm also Anne's colleague at Heritage of Hunger, and for this project I focus on the Great Irish Famine of the mid-19th century.
Lindsay and I both work for Heritages of Hunger, which is a project which comparatively investigates recollections of European periods of hunger, as these periods, in fact, have long legacies that still tend to impact current debates about, for example, questions regarding refugees, Brexit, and COVID-19. And we speak about the continued relevance of famine pasts with three guests. With Professor Miguel Angel del Arcor Blanco, we discussed the Spanish Hunger Years between 1939 and 1952. With Professor Laurence, or Laurie, Gourivedi of Clermont Auvergne University, we talk about the Scottish Highland clearances between 1750 and 1880. And with Marta Bazyuk, whom you already heard in the introduction, we discussed the Ukrainian Holodomor. Before diving into the topic of remembrance of these difficult pasts, let's briefly summarize their histories. First, you will listen to Laurie explaining the history of the Highland clearances.
The clearances occurred in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, so that northern Scotland. The process was a process of transformation of the region in socioeconomic terms. It was the agrarian reforms that were put into place by landholders and in order to make the local agriculture more commercial, direct it towards the market, so move away from a form of subsistence farming and towards more commercial agriculture. And in the process of this transformation, which to some extent, you know, largely revolved around the introduction of sheep farming, a lot of people, a lot of the local communities, the people who lived in small villages in the valleys were displaced, were evicted, because the places, the valleys where they lived were the most fertile and very, you know, congenial to the development of sheep farming. And these people were either relocated to the coast where new industries were developed, they got into fishing and so on, or they migrated because sometimes no resettlement was provided for them. So together with economic changes, you had a lot of social and cultural disruption because people had to move from places where they had lived at times for generations. So it was very traumatic. During this long protracted period of changes, which was from the middle of the 18th century to the late 19th century, because the end of it, the landmark for the end of this period is the 1886 Crofters Act, you had the period of the Highland Famine, which lasted from the middle of the 1840s to around about 1851. And so if you want, this period of famine is, I often present it as opposed to Ireland, for which it is quite a massive event in terms of identity, traumatic event. It's not the case in the Highlands and Islands. For many different reasons, the trauma is linked with the clearances. And the famine is just a comma, if you want, in this narrative. Okay, it's an episode, it's a chapter in a long story of exploitation, of hardship, and so on.
Whereas the famine during the Highland clearances is remembered as, in the words of Laurie, a comma within a longer narrative of exploitation, the Ukrainian Holodomor has played a significant role in processes of national identity formation in post-Soviet Ukraine. Here's Martha telling us about it.
So in 1917, Bolsheviks ultimately prevailed and established rule in the Soviet Union. Most Ukrainians were not supportive of the Bolshevik Ukraine. About 80% of Ukrainians were peasant farmers at the time. By 1928, the Soviet authorities had embarked on a policy of collectivization. So these peasant farmers, this 80% of the Ukrainian population, was not fond of the plan. They were private farmers. They did not want to become mere workers on large Soviet state collective farms, and they fought vociferously. And the most active among them, often the community leaders, many of them were sent to the Gulag. And part of the process was to villainize them. They were class enemies called kulaks. By 1932-33, the year we're talking about of this famine, the Soviet Union was embarking on a policy of rapid industrialization, and they had to finance this. So part of the plan was to sell grain internationally, and they set impossibly high quotas that Ukraine was to deliver to the state. When they were notified by local authorities that these quotas were impossibly high, they actually increased the quotas. They closed the borders to Ukraine so the starving peasants couldn't leave. They made it a crime punishable by death to take as much as a handful of grain from the field after it had been harvested. And they when the International Red Cross approached and offered international food aid, they denied there was a famine in the country. And as a consequence, there were at least 4 million deaths in Ukraine.
While the Holodomor can be seen in the context of imperialism, the Spanish famine was inflicted by the Spanish dictator Franco himself. Miguel explains the period as follows.
Well, the Spanish famine is a famine that took place in the interwar years of the 20th century. So basically it's originated by the policy developed by the Francoist regime. Although there are other causes that are affected, like the destruction of the civil war and other problems derived from the World War II, like the international blockade. But the main reason for the Spanish famine would be the autarkic policy developed by the Francoist dictatorship. Until recently, it has been silenced because the Francoist regime never talked about it. And after the death of the dictator in 1975, there were no studies to make a research about what really happened, because basically we were interested in other aspects. The historians like the violence, the origin of the Spanish Civil War, and other issues. So it's a recently discovered famine, We estimate that it took place between 1939 and 1942, and the number of victims varied a lot. Among the different studies, they say that it could be 200,000 victims just in 3 years, and other historians talk about 600,000 victims. And this work needs to be done because we have the problem of the civil war coming before the famine. Many deaths were ascribed after the war, so this is a problem that we have.
So, as mentioned, famine periods can be seen as living histories. Miguel explains how the Spanish Hunger Years was silenced for a long time and only recently received public attention.
Well, the famine as such is not explicitly in any film, in any Spanish film, because the Spanish famine has been silenced for many years and it has been recently discovered by the scholars that study the past. So obviously there was a work to be done by us, by the scholars, right? What we find in the Spanish movies are mentions about the post-war years. For many decades, they were not common. But recently, since the movement for the recovery of the historical memory, since year 2000, they're starting to appear more and more. Basically, what they reflect is how, in the post-war year, the society was divided between defeated and victors, and how victors control food, how victors control the state, and obviously they develop and they use their policies to punish the defeated and, of course, to feather their own nests.
Not only modern famines can be seen as living histories. As the Scottish Highland clearances happened over 150 years ago, but are currently being recalled in context of Black Lives Matter and slavery. As Laurie explained just now, the clearances are not only about famine, but rather about the creation of an exploitative economy featuring forced eviction, enslavement and famine. She tells us about the research of a student she supervises, Maxime Martin.
And if I move to present days, which is something I've had my students working on at the moment, it's looking at Highland history from the perspective of Black Lives Matter and looking at slavery. So she's looking at the way now that particular history is refocused from the angle of that economic angle of the involvement of a lot of landowners in the slave trade. So it depends on the way, and of course you've had even museums have invited now speakers to give papers about the Highlands and the slave trade, the Highlands and slavery, and it's something which has been picked up since very much 2007. It's really that was the commemoration of the abolition of the slave trade, which became a big thing in Scotland and of course in the Highlands. Some scholars had started investigating this before this particular period, but it was not yet the right time, wasn't that popular. But now it's become extremely important, and it's in Scotland, Glasgow is also a city which has been reinterpreted from that particular angle. So the Highlands are part of this movement as well.
Periods of hunger, famine and exploitation are thus recalled according to the demands of the present and are used to give meaning to current societal issues. And this also works the other way around, in the sense that current issues impact how we remember the past.
In Ukraine, you have to remember that it's actually dangerous to be involved in the study of Holodomor heritage, famine heritage, anywhere where Russian occupation is a possibility. So the people who are involved in museum work, who are involved in academic study of the famine, they are people who, when there's a Russian occupation force, are likely on the lists of people to be subject to some kind of persecution. So it's an act of bravery right now to even continue in anything that can be considered a study of Ukrainian history. Outside of Ukraine in the diaspora, We'll see. November is the month when we commemorate the Holodomor, but I imagine that commemorations of the Holodomor will take on a different kind of tone, where you're not only commemorating and remembering the people who died in 1932-33, but there will be an aspect of remembering those who continue to die today defending the country.
Because has that been part, because I honestly don't know, has it been part of sort of the annual commemoration more often, that sort of that day is also used to draw out analogies, comparisons, reflections on what we have and have not learned since then?
The commemorations of the Holodomor for years took place before there was an independent Ukraine. So they would have been an opportunity to try to bring attention to this state of Ukraine and to violations of human rights, for example, within the Soviet Union. Then you had independence, and they took on another tone, that today we're able to freely talk about something that was denied for so long, and we do that together with our brothers and sisters in Ukraine. Now, in the context of the war, there's a feeling of grief that, again, we are remembering people who are losing their lives to aggression that we want the world to be aware of and to do what it can to stop.
So memory impacts our perception of current crises, such as wars, and current events equally impacts how we remember past famines. In other words, we could say that memory is fluid and flexible. Laurie also sees this flexibility of memory manifest itself in, for example, museum exhibitions.
I remember when I started moving into museums, reading a book by a lady called Gaynor Kavanagh, who wrote about history curatorship. So she dealt with museums, okay? And she was saying that very often the stories that are told in museums depend on present priorities, okay? So people prioritize the story that they choose to tell in museums, depending on present concerns. And I found that extremely persuasive. And then obviously I found the same thing in Nora. Nora was developing his work at the same time, Les Lieux de Mémoire. And he was speaking about commemorations in particular. He's got a chapter at the end of his many volumes which deal with commemoration. And he speaks about, in French, it's c'est le présent qui crée ses instruments de commémoration, l'histoire propose et le présent dispose, which I thought, I'm going to translate that. It's a lovely sentence. It says, you know, the present creates its own commemorative tools. History offers a panel and the present chooses what to actually, you know, develop and commemorate, okay? And you found that, you know, a lot of social scientists, in particular, you know, in France, from his work, a lot of people started delving into memory and used that particular approach. And then when I was doing my own work, I read a lot of material from written in English. And I suppose one of the books as well, which I found very interesting, which had exactly the same take, was James Young, The Texture of Memory, which had which dealt with the Holocaust. And obviously the Holocaust period is a great period which has inspired a lot of work for social scientists that dealt with memory. And he also had the same statement in his introduction, when he said, you know, commemorations is something which is quite flexible, which is not frozen in time, and very much responds to the hue of the moment, okay? So I found that, again, very convincing. And since then, it's really something that I have noticed in a lot of commemorative processes and memory work, that a lot of the inflections that you get in the way the past is interpreted come from present needs.
The story told about famine periods by museums and cultural organizations is not only dependent on the needs of the present, but also on the few material objects available for curators to display. We can see that there's a material scarcity with regard to famine pasts, as societal groups struck by famine obviously often had few personal possessions.
In the work of HREC, the Holodomor Research Education Consortium, we are sometimes up against the fact that there's little visual evidence of this famine. There are really, it's not much more than a handful of photos. There were a few foreigners who managed to smuggle out a few photos of the Holodomor, and there was one local photographer. And researchers stumbled upon these photos in an archive in Chernihiv. They're not in some political KGB archive in Moscow, but they were in a common criminal case file from the 30s. And those photos were found, they were brought to Kyiv, they constitute one of the most valuable rare sources on Holodomor evidence, visual evidence. That archive, the physical building, was shelled recently during the war and no longer exists. If they hadn't been rescued and preserved some 10 years back, that would be one of the only visual sources destroyed forever. So the physical preservation of these materials, you know, when they were preserved, it was considered an important act, but nobody knew how important it was. No one predicted that that physical archive would be destroyed under Russian shelling in 2022.
This last example ties in very well with your comment earlier, not just on how the current war will change remembrance practices, but also will impact the way that we do research. And this is the most tangible example that you could do, that actually that you could provide, that it actually has the potential to destroy elements that we have from that past, and that if these aren't salvaged, that repertoire, that archive will get lost.
Marta's words lay bare the tension between history and memory, which is something Miguel also sees in his research when interviewing survivors of the Spanish famine.
History wants to be complex, and the famine history has to be more complex because it has to talk about defeated, but they had to talk also about the victors, the ones that ruled the country, the ones that developed the policies, right? So it is not only about resistance, it's also about power, right? Of how the food supplies are supplied to the population, how the economic system work. So after all, history is a very complex narrative with pros and contrasts, and it deserves time. Memory is more simplistic. A good example of that is when we interview some people that had lived during the famine, or they were growing up during the famine. They have a partial memory of what happened. Basically, their memory is not only based in what they saw, it's also based in what happened to them afterwards, and even the situation that they have now. A good example of this with the Spanish famine is that it's very hard to find people that recognized that they suffer hunger in their family, because hunger is about dignity too. And there are really few testimonies that recognized that they had to eat like things that normally were not eaten, like, as we know, because we have studied this, like cats, like herbs, things that were not normally eaten. You're never gonna find that in a personal memory, because it talks about not only their dignity, it talks about the dignity of their family. So obviously that's distorted or erased or silenced in the individual memories.
So far, we've talked about how past periods of hunger are still very much alive today. We've heard how they have been politicized and how their memory has changed over time. But what's the meaning of studying famine and famine memory in today's society? Let's conclude this episode with a word from Miguel about how memories of different hunger pasts can offer the potential to promote transcultural and transhistorical understanding.
From my point of view, a cosmopolitan memory is a memory that overcomes borders, national borders, but also cultures. I mean, it's a memory that overcomes countries, cultures, and also social classes. Obviously, this is quite hard because it has to be a complex memory. We know that it's not going to be alone forever. I mean, there are going to be many memories contesting this cosmopolitan memory. But I think that we have to manage, as we did with the memory of World War II, to find a common ground for a common memory that could be changed, but that should be democratic and cosmopolitan, that no distinction between races or social classes or nations. Because thinking about famine is also thinking about capitalism. And we know that our survival or our economical process is connected with what's going on in other economies or in other parts of the world. So studying famine in Europe means to study what was going on in other parts of the globe. And of course, if famines are not taking place in Europe, might be taking place in other parts of the world. A good example of that is the actual war in Ukraine. We don't have famine, but you know that due to our internal conflicts, we're creating famine, or we're fomenting famine in Africa and other parts of the world.
Thank you for listening to this Neil Rewind episode on past European famines and their present legacies. This episode is a product of a collaboration. First of all, Lindsay and I would like to thank our three guests, Marta Bazouk, Miguel Ángel de Arco Blanco, and Laurence Gourividi. A special word of thanks also goes to past and present members of the Heritages of Hunger Research Group for sharing their thoughts on the workings of famine memory. Ingrid de Zwarte, Marguerite Corporaal, Lotte Jensen, Anneliese Bobeldijk, Gloria Roman Ruiz, Charlie Boerman and Deborah Madden.